ask Brother Reuben then to speak on Samson, a man of faith. Brother Reuben.
Thanks, Luke. Evening, everyone. Hopefully you can hear me. Really nice to see you all again, especially so soon after last time. I promise after this I'll disappear for a good few months, though. we're going to look at Samson. I think we know, an awful lot about him. I think he's one of the most fascinating characters in the Bible. And I suppose the premise of this evening is that I'm going to suggest that sometimes we perhaps misjudge him. We know that Samson comes to judge Israel at a time of total apathy. You know, the children of Israel are not crying to God for his help. They have reached a state of mind where they're totally prepared to accept the status quo. They don't want anyone to come and disturb the situation. It's got its problems, it's got its difficulties, but they've come to live with things. It's manageable. They've come to terms with their apostasy, and they've justified it. Much like our world today. And we know that the story actually begins, don't we, in the previous chapter, in chapter 13. We know that an angel comes to Manoah and his wife, and at the start of chapter 13, it tells us that the Lord, or Yahweh, delivered them into the hand of the Philistines 40 years. And we can't miss that, can we? We know how symbolic it is. We know the wilderness wandering was for 40 years. But why were they in the wilderness? Well, we know, don't we? Deuteronomy 8 and verse 2 tells us, thou shalt remember all the way in which the Lord thy God led thee these 40 years in the wilderness. And here's the reason: to humble thee, to prove thee, to know what was in thine heart, whether thou would keep his commandments or not. That was the purpose of the 40 years, that they would be humbled, that they would be proved, that their hearts would be examined by God to see what they really felt and thought. And so it is when we come to chapter 13 of Judges, there's no mention here of the people crying to God. But they've sunk so low as a nation that they're beyond recognition. And all the work is of God. They don't ask for him. They are given Samson. Given to them by God. And he's from the tribe of Dan. And when the people came into the land of Israel, numerically, Dan was one of the largest tribes. But it was also one of the weakest tribes when it came to faith. So weak was their faith that when the inhabitants of the land opposed them taking the land that had been allotted to them, they said, well, I don't like this very much, so let's go somewhere else. Let's go to a better place where we get less aggravation. So that's what they did. And we know that they headed north. They left behind the place that God had allocated to them because they didn't want the work of getting it. And they went somewhere they could get a better, quieter life. And we're so like that, aren't we, brothers and sisters? If we can avoid the difficulties of life, then we will. And yet we know at the same time, don't we, that God brings those experiences into our lives. And yet, sadly, all we try to do is get out of them. And we all know that the purpose of God with us is not that we avoid those problems. It's that we lean on him and ask him to help us deal with them. It's actually for the same reason that they were in the wilderness, wasn't it? So that we can be humbled and proved, so that God can see what's in our hearts. That's why we have these sorts of experiences. We all know that we're not called to a rose bed in the truth. We're not called to a life of tranquility. And here in this story of Samson, we're being introduced to a child who was going to be unlike every other child in the village. And we know that his mother was barren, and that the angel comes with the message that she's going to have a child. And you know, the things in your mind, the pictures in your mind are already building up as I say that, aren't they? You're seeing the similarities, aren't you? It's that old thing of Bible echoes. And we can see the links, and we can see the patterns of how God works. And this family are different to the other Danites, aren't we? And how do we know that? Well, verse 2 tells us in chapter 13, there was a certain man of Zorah of the family of the Danites whose name was Manoah. And the question we have to ask ourselves is, well, where's Zorah? Without cheating and looking at the back of your Bibles. Well, it's actually an area that was allocated originally to the tribe of Dan. So that tells us that this man had stayed where God had put him. He hadn't gone off looking for an easier life up north with the rest of them. He'd said, well, this is the land that God has intended we have. This is the portion for our tribe, and that's where I'm going to stay until I'm sent somewhere else. So there he is with his family or his wife, learning to accept the burden of life in this place. But his wife couldn't have any children. And the message from the angel was, well, you're going to have a son, but he'll be a Nazarite from the womb. And I think that's an awesome responsibility, brothers and sisters. And it does bring home a very important point, doesn't it? It's the lesson of parenting and nurturing our children. And I suppose our grandchildren and our young people and children in our meeting. And perhaps we don't always think about it. But this child who was going to grow up a Nazarite from the womb is later described in the New Testament as someone who would, through faith, subdue kingdoms, stop the mouth of the lion, escape the edge of the sword, out of weakness, be made strong. He'll wax valiant in fight and turn to flight the army of the alien. This was the one who would achieve all of those things by being a Nazarite from the womb. And of course, I'm sure you know and have marked up that this story of Samson has many, many parallels with John the Baptist, the forerunner of Jesus. When we look at the lives of Samson and John the Baptist, it's clear to see the pattern and the way that God works. Both of these men are born to barren women by the power of God. They both spent time in the wilderness. They're both driven or strengthened by the Spirit. They both suffer violent deaths by women. And their work was completed by those who came after them. So here's a man then who's raised up by God. But the work he's going to accomplish starts in the womb. Didn't start and it doesn't start when they go to Sunday school or come to the meeting or study class or when they get baptized, does it? It actually starts at the moment of conception. That's when the work actually starts. And in that sense, it is an awesome responsibility when we look at it like that. And what did the angel say in verse 4 of chapter 13? Now, therefore, beware, I pray thee, and drink not wine nor strong drink, and eat not any unclean thing. And who's got to do that? Well, that's what the woman's got to do. She's going to bear the son. Now, that, I would suggest, is not the familiar pattern of parenthood, is it? You know, I'm finding this out every day. Lucas and Theo are incredibly good at doing this. Now, if I'm not setting a good example, they know about it. They're the first ones to remind me about it. And naturally, it's hard sometimes to set the example, isn't it? We want them to do the right thing and we tell them what to do, but we don't always set the example ourselves. And the problem with that is that if there's one group of people that see through us like a glass door, then it's our children. If I'm a hypocrite, then the first person to know it is one of the two monkeys that lives here. And if we're going to bring up our children in the way that they should go, then we have to start getting into the habit of doing the things we want our children to do before they even turn up. It's quite hard to start it after that, isn't it? There's a conflict of interest. And the record's telling us that the child is going to be brought up in the example of his parents, and therefore for the mother to be able to say to Samson, you must do this and you can't do that, then she had to set the example as well. And when you look at these words, you know, it meant setting out a pattern of life that was different to everybody else. And we know it's detailed in Numbers chapter 6. We haven't got time to look at it, but we know they couldn't have wine, strong drink, they couldn't come into contact with dead bodies, they couldn't cut their hair all their days, that they were separate unto Yahweh. And she, Samson's mother, had to accept all of those conditions herself before she could teach them to her child. And I'm sure we all feel that is a searchlight that drops on all of us, whether we're parents or grandparents or aunts and uncles. You know, it makes us realize just what a responsibility we have. And of course, there was no way that the Son of God could be perfect unless the Father was before him. God can say, be ye holy, for I am holy, and he means it. Apostle Peter could say the same thing applies to us, that God calls us to holiness because he is holy. God is separate, and so must we be. So imagine the childhood for little Samson. He was going to be different to every other child around him. You know, he couldn't have his hair cut, which I suppose would have been a novelty to start with, but as life went on, I suppose it wasn't quite as much fun. Of course, I am jealous because I'd love some hair back, but you know, other children can be quite cruel, can't they? he'd have to be very particular, very fussy about his diet. If he did go to any of his friends' house to stay and eat, then he'd have to be very carefully catered for. His mother would have to say, remember, Samson, you can't have this and you mustn't touch that. So maybe he wasn't invited out all that often because he would need a special meal for everywhere that he went. And of course, if there was a family funeral, then he would be excluded. He couldn't go anywhere near a dead body. So the childhood for Samson would be very different. He'd be taught as a child that his calling was quite distinct from all the other children round about him. And that is the one thing that children don't like, isn't it? They don't like being different from everybody else, generally speaking, I mean. And I suppose as adults, we're not always that much different either. We don't like to stand out, prefer to blend in and be camouflaged. But as we've seen, if we don't start teaching our children from an early age that they are different and they understand why they're different, we're going to have a bit of a struggle, aren't we? They need to know that they can't go to those places and they're not going to be doing those things and they won't be bought those particular items. And we have to explain to them that that's the case because it's just not in accordance with what we believe. And naturally, that sets up an antagonism. But we all have to go through it, don't we? We've all been through it as young people, probably with our parents. There's no getting around it. We know, don't we, that when the record said that the Lord Jesus Christ learned obedience by the things that he suffered, it actually means that. It wasn't easy for him to learn obedience. It brought deep groanings, it brought strong tears from the Lord Jesus to submit himself to the Father's will. And it isn't just a question of saying to our children, do as I say, not as I do. Because we have to learn to submit ourselves, first of all, to the will of our Heavenly Father. And only then are we in a strong enough position to teach our children to go through the same process. Now, when I look back to my childhood, now I'm very grateful, not just for the things that my parents verbally taught me. I'm more grateful for the example that they set me. You know, I learned from a very early age that nothing was allowed to interfere with the ecclesial activities of my family. There was no way in which my parents would let any activity at all encroach on a Sunday. And no matter how much I or my friends or the school pleaded with my parents, you know, they refused. And you know, I used to remember feeling outraged that this budding talent wasn't allowed to go and do what he wanted to do on Sundays. But I look back now and what I realise is that they were right. They did know best. And I learned from a very early age that there was something important to them that they were very intent on passing on to me. And they set me an example in that way. And I'm very grateful for that. So when we come to the life of Samson, we see that when the angel said he was going to be a Nazarite from the womb, he was teaching his mother this first lesson of parenting. First of all, we have to submit ourselves to God before we ask our children to do the same thing. So Samson's brought up in the way and in the example of his mother, and we don't get told very much about his childhood, but we do see a little bit about his father. He was quite frightened when his wife came back and tells him she's met an angel and she's received this message. And he says, well, I want to hear the message too. But the angel comes back again, and this time his wife fetches him and they listen to the message, they offer a sacrifice, and the angel ascends up in the flames, and Manoah falls down saying that they've seen the face of Yahweh and they'll surely die. And his wife, you know, ever the realist, aren't they? They're always the realists. You know, she says, don't be silly. If he wanted us dead, we'd already be dead. If the angel was going to kill us, he'd already have done it. You know, we've got a different job to do, so let's get on and do it. So, as ever, we know that our wives are the practical half of the partnership, don't we? And perhaps that's why in verse 24 it says that the woman bare a son and called his name Samson, and the child grew, the Lord blessed him, and the Spirit of the Lord began to move him in the tribe of Dan between Zorah and Eshtaol. So we are moving from his childhood, his early Nazarite life, into the work of Samson now. And we come to the very first incident in chapter 14 as we read it. And we're going to see a wedding in this chapter. And we're told that it was to a woman who's a daughter of somebody in Timnath. And of course, I suppose the traditional view here is that people say, well, this is Samson, he's off now. Here he is. The last verse of chapter 13 tells us that the Spirit starts to move him. And then in chapter 14, we have this incident. And people say, well, this is the lust of the eyes. It's the pride of life. It's the lust of the flesh. What an awful thing to go and do. What an awful man Samson was. But he does do a few good things and in sort of because of that, scrapes into Hebrews chapter 11 as a faithful man. I just don't think that's right. Because there's a very interesting phrase, isn't there, in chapter 4, that for me, chapter 14, that for me explains a great deal to me. It actually explains the whole story of Samson. And his parents would have had the same problem as others have had. They'd have thought, well, what's he doing? They'd be thinking, we brought him up as a Nazarite. He knows what the truth is. The Spirit of the Lord is upon him. He's doing things for God, but now he wants to marry this daughter of Timnath. But the clue's there, isn't it? It's right in front of us. Verse 4, his father and his mother knew not that it was of Yahweh, it was of the Lord that he sought an occasion against the Philistines. Now, I don't mind what you say, and I don't care how you look at it or how you cut it or which version you use. You cannot delete those words. There's no escaping that this happened because God wanted it to. It wasn't that Samson misbehaved and God took the opportunity to make the most of that situation. It clearly says it was an occasion from the Lord. So we have this incident here where he goes down to Timnath and the young lion roars and the Spirit of the Lord came upon him and he rent the lion. Now, think about that context of this incident. Think about why that's there. Here's Samson moving about the nation, starting to judge the people through the power of the Spirit. He goes down to Timnath, that this lion roars and the Spirit of the Lord comes upon him and he kills the lion. So what sort of man is this? Is it a lustful man, a faithless man? And of course, it's a parable, isn't it? The killing of the lion's a parable. You have a picture of the lion being slain and honey comes out. And this is a parable about the work that Samson can do for the nation. Samson's representative of the nation. He's the one raised up. The lion represents the Philistines who are oppressing them. And the point of the parable is that Israel can defeat and destroy the lion, the oppressor. And out of that destruction will come great blessing. But it's the power of God that can do it. But they've got to put their trust in him. So he goes to Timnath and he meets the woman and she's well pleasing for his purpose, I suggest. And his father organises it and then it comes the time for this wedding. But it's a strange wedding, isn't it? Do you realise that they're all there from the bride's side? There's no one there from the bridegroom's side, though. Do you notice that when it comes down to the time of the wedding, that Samson's there? There's no mention of his family. None of them have come with him. And so he tells them the riddle. And we know what happens, that they threaten his would-be wife. They say, if you don't find out the answer to this riddle, then we'll burn you and your father's house with fire. You've got to find the answer. You can't let this Israelite beat us. So eventually we know that she gets the answer and she tells them and they tell him. And verse 18 of chapter 14, we see his response. If you'd not ploughed with my heifer, you'd not found out my riddle. So the Spirit of the Lord came upon him and he went down to Ashkelon and slew 30 men of them and took their spoil and gave a change of garment unto them, which expounded the riddle. And his anger was kindled and he went up to his father's house. But Samson's wife was given to his companion whom he had used as his friend. Now, do you notice something about this story? There's no record here of the wedding actually taking place. She's betrothed to him, but the woman who was to become his wife became someone else's wife. There's no actual account in chapter 14 of a wedding ceremony actually taking place. And they're actually dealing with this woman in the incident, and they go to her for the answer, but there's no actual record of the consummation of this marriage. There's no record of the wife being taken and becoming the actual wife of Samson, but we know from verse 4 that it was an occasion from the Lord. And that means he can turn up later and he says, okay, I think I'll have my wife now. And they say, oh, sorry about that. We've given it to someone else. And then you see in chapter 15 the destruction of their crops and his judgment upon the Philistines. But it brings us back to chapter 14 and verse 4, that it was all of Yahweh that he sought an occasion against the Philistines. It was all pre-planned. The Philistines thought they had the upper hand, but they fell into his trap. They thought this, they took his woman and they gave her to another man. They got their reward for getting the riddle, but it was at the cost and expense of their own people. And as a consequence of them giving away the woman that was to be his wife, he destroyed their crops. And what happened to that family as a consequence? Well, we'll look at verse 6 of chapter 15. Then the Philistines said, "Who hath done this?" And they answered, "Samson, the son-in-law of the Timnite, because he'd taken his wife and given her to his companion." And the Philistines came up and burnt her and her father with fire. The very thing that this family tried to avoid through finding out the answer to the riddle was the very fate that they suffered. And that is a salutary lesson, isn't it, brothers and sisters? Sometimes the things we try to avoid the most are actually caused by our actions, because we haven't done the right thing in the sight of God. So what I'm simply suggesting in chapter 14 is that there was no actual marriage. Yes, there was one arranged, but it was never consummated. And the actions of the Philistines in both guessing the riddle and giving the woman to someone else, the occasion that Samson needed to act in judgment against the oppressor, all because it was of the Lord. And you see how this activity, how these actions bring about a chain reaction, because not what you find next is that the children of Israel and the children of Judah in particular illustrate the apathy of this people under oppression. They actually come to him in chapter 15 and verse 12, don't they? And they say, "We're come down to bind thee, that we may deliver thee into the hand of the Philistine." They don't want Samson to keep creating these sorts of problems. They don't want him upsetting the Philistines because it's making life difficult for them. 3,000 of them turn up to get hold of him, to get rid of him, to give him over to the Philistines, so they can hand him over and life can go back to like it was before. So he responds in the second half of verse 12. He says, "Swear unto me that you'll not fall upon me yourselves." So he says, "All right, I'll go along with this as long as you promise not to hurt me yourselves." You know, what an amazing sight that is. 3,000 men of Judah coming to look for Samson. Thousands of men turn up at his parents' door. You know, he opened the door. Imagine seeing that. "Hello. Come with us." 3,000 of them. And he says, "Okay, I'll let you tie me up, but just don't hurt me yourself." And so you can see a collective sigh of relief on 3,000 faces, can't you? You know, they think, "Oh, that was easy. Whew. We've got Samson. Life can go back to normal. Anything for a quiet life." Verse 13, they said, "No, but we'll bind thee fast. We'll deliver thee into their hand, but surely we'll not kill thee." And they bound him with two new cords and brought him up from the rock. And when he came unto Lehi, the Philistines shouted. And that word is worth highlighting for one reason. You've already seen that word in the story of Samson. The word "shouted" there is the same word as the word for where the lion roared in chapter 14. The word "roar" and the word "shouting" are the same thing. And you can see the connection, can't you, between the lion, who is the oppressor, the Philistines. And the Spirit of the Lord came upon him, came mightily upon him. So just remember, this is the man that we say is lustful, faithless, and driven by human nature. And the cords that were upon his arms became as flax that was burnt with fire, and his bands loosed off his hands, and he found a new jawbone of an ass and put forth his hand and took it and slew 1,000 men therewith. And we know what happened, don't we? It's an incredible battle when you think about it. And he's desperately thirsty by the end. And he needs God to support him. And we know that God does that in verse 19. God clave a hollow place that was in the jaw, and there came water thereout. And when he had drunk, his spirit came again, and he revived. Wherefore he called the name thereof En-Hakkor, so that the hill of the jawbone, the place where God delivered him, and his thirst was quenched. So we see a man raises a Nazarite into a life that's distinct and separate. There's a man who's moved by the Spirit of God, and he starts to judge Israel. the man who sought an occasion from the law to judge against the oppressor, and he finds it. A man who now wipes out 1,000 Philistines with the jawbone of an ass. Well, now we come to chapter 16, and you might be sitting there thinking, ha-ha, the Roo, got away with chapter 14, maybe, and the record of no wedding or no marriage, but how are you going to get away with chapter 16? Because in chapter 16, it says that Samson goes to Gaza, and he spies a harlot, and he goes into the harlot's house. So you've got some trouble explaining this one, haven't you? Or have I? Because, brothers and sisters, where did the spies go that were sent into the land by Joshua? Where did the two spies go that came to Jericho? Well, they went into the house of Rahab, the harlot, didn't they? Well, yeah, but that was different. Why was it different? Well, that was an inn. Well, that's true. But why would spies go there? Well, they'd go there because they could find out a lot of information about the enemy, couldn't they? In the house of a harlot. But let's just ask ourselves a few questions. Just apply logic to this situation. Firstly, why would he go all the way to Gaza? This is the capital city of his enemy. Why go to a harlot's house in the capital city of his enemy and not think that the enemy would know he was there? He's just killed 1,000 of them. He's the most wanted man in the whole of the land. Strange, isn't it? I mean, if he was that desperate for that sort of relationship, why travel all the way to Gaza? And what happens? Well, look at verse 2. And it was told the Gazites, saying, Samson is come hither. And they compassed him in, and they laid wait for him all night in the gate of the city, and were quiet all the night, saying, in the morning, when it's day, we shall kill him. So they thought, well, he's in there now, he won't be out until the morning, so we'll let him enjoy himself, we'll lock the gates, and we'll set a trap for when he comes out tomorrow. But what does he do? Doesn't come out in the morning, does he? He comes out when they least expected it. Verse 3, and Samson lay till midnight, arose at midnight, and took the doors of the gate of the city and the two posts, and went away with them, bar and all, and put them upon his shoulders, and carried them to the top of an hill that is before Hebron. So why does he do that? Why does he put them on his back at all? Why doesn't he just take them off their hinges and gently put them outside of the city and trot off? He picks them up, puts them on his back, and he runs 40 miles with them, 40 miles to the city of Hebron. Now that sounds just like a man who's gone to the house of harlot, doesn't it? That's just the sort of thing a man like that would do. Incredible. Where does he get all the energy from? Running 40 miles with the city gate on his back in the middle of the night. Doesn't make sense, does it? Except it does, when you remember what Hebron was famous for. Hebron was a city of refuge. It was the inheritance of Caleb. It was the place where Abraham had lived and built an altar. In fact, all the patriarchs had lived there at some time, but most importantly of all, it was the burial place of Abraham, Sarah, Isaac, Rebekah, Jacob, and Leah. And Samson carried those gates, which were from the capital, that the head city of his enemy, and he took them and he placed them in the place that the patriarchs are buried. Now, does that sound to you like the actions of a man who's full of lust and desire? Or does it sound to you like the actions of a man who has thought out, planned, and carefully executed the example, a parable, a lesson for the people of Israel in response to their attempt to hand him over to the Philistines? And it's comical, really, isn't it, when you think about it? Because, of course, the next morning, when the Philistines woke up, they'd say, well, who's nipped the gates? Where are the gates gone? Well, it was Samson. Well, where are they? They're at Hebron. Why are they at Hebron? I don't know. And the people of Hebron would wake up and they'd say, where have those gates come from? Well, Samson's brought them. Well, where have they come from? Gaza. What's he bringing them here for? You know, there'll be trouble now, won't there? The Gazites won't like that. Well, why has he brought them here? Well, that was the very question he wanted them to ask. Why had he brought these gates? Why has he brought the gates from Gaza to this place? And I know that you know the answer, even if you don't think you do. Just hold your hand in Judges and come back with me to Genesis chapter 2, because here's the answer. And it's ever so simple, but it's beautifully executed. Genesis chapter 22, verse 17 says, "But in blessing I will bless thee, in multiplying I will multiply thy seed as the stars of the heaven, and as the sand which is upon the seashore. And thy seed shall possess the gate of his enemies." Samson was reminding the people of their forefathers, of the foundation of their faith, of the promises that God had made. And what he's saying is, you are an apathetic, useless, lazy people. If only you can see what God is doing for you. Why can't you rise up? You rise up and you can cast off the oppressor and you'll be free. Now to Abraham and his seed were the promises made, and he saith not unto seeds as of many, but as of one, unto thy seed, which is Christ. The enemy ultimately is death. The keys of death and of the grave have been unlocked by the Lord Jesus Christ. Here was Samson foreshadowing the work of Jesus, both in his death and resurrection and in the establishment of the kingdom to come. Here was the work that Samson was trying to put before his people. He's not a man weighed down by sinful nature. It's a man who's moved by the Spirit of the Lord when there was no eye to pity and no arm to save. This is a child raised as a Nazarite from the womb, separate and distinct. This is the one who, by Yahweh, found an occasion to judge the oppressor. And having gone out and found out the weaknesses of his enemy via the captains and the soldiers of the Philistine army who passed through that place, that there was all the gossip and the news and the intelligence that he needed that evening. And he made the most of that information in teaching his people a lesson. Here's a man foreshadowing the work of Jesus Christ. I think it's as simple as that. So we come finally to the saddest part of the story. And this really is a tragedy. It's a romantic tragedy. Because in verse 4, we read, "It came to pass afterward that he loved a woman in the valley of Sorek, whose name was Delilah." Do you see it said he loved a woman? Doesn't say that about the woman at Timnath. There's no mention of love in Gaza. This is a man now whose heart has been captured. And she's from the valley of Sorek. Well, where's Sorek? Without looking at your atlas. It's in the same place as Zora. That's where it is in your atlas. It's just along the road. So what does that tell us? Well, it tells us that she probably wasn't a Gentile, that she was actually a Jew. She was one of his own, and they'd fallen in love, and she betrayed him. And the echoes are starting to build up again, aren't they? That the pattern's taking shape for us once more. Here's a man who chooses his own, who comes to his own, but his own receive him not. What do we know about Delilah? Well, we know that her name means languishing. The root meaning of the name or the word is feeble or oppressed or brought low. And she's a type of the nation. She betrayed her deliverer for money. The love of money, as we know, is the root of all evil. And that's what we know about Delilah. She came from the area that Samson grew up in. And at the start of verse 5, it says that the Lord of the Philistines came up unto her. So they didn't send for her, like they did with the woman of Timnath. They didn't make demands of her. They had to bribe Delilah. That was the only way they were going to get anywhere. And the bribe was enormous, wasn't it? 100 pieces of silver. It's a huge bribe. And if she was a Philistine, I suggest they didn't need to do that. They just used to threaten again like they had previously. But she didn't live in their territory. She wasn't a Philistine. And you notice, don't you, that throughout this chapter, whenever Samson's attacked, she describes them as "the Philistines be upon thee." Verse 9, verse 12, verse 14, verse 20. And we know the events, don't we? We know how she wrestles Samson to give up his secret, the secret of his strength. And as we read down this chapter 16, we can see what we're being presented with, can't we? The request of the Philistines was there in verse 5, it says that they came unto her, said unto her, entice him, and see wherein his great strength lieth, and by what means we might prevail against him, that we may bind him to afflict him. So they wanted to bind and afflict him. The word afflict means to humble and bring low. And we know how he tricks Delilah 3 times before he finally succumbs. In verse 19, we see that he loses his strength at last. She made him sleep upon her knees. She called for a man, and she caused him to shave off the 7 locks of his head. And she began to afflict him, and his strength went from him. And she said, the Philistines be upon thee, Samson. And he awoke out of his sleep and said, I'll go out as other times before and shake myself. And he wist not that the Lord was departed from him. This is the only time, isn't it, in the record of Samson's judgeship that we're told that the Lord departs from him. So in all the other instances and all the other occasions that we have in this narrative, I think we have to rightly assume that God was with him, which I can't reconcile with a lustfully driven man who's wandering around Israel causing havoc. This is a man of faith. He's a man of substance. He's a man who sought to do the will of God. I think it's just that we look at it from a human point of view. We read the record from a human point of view instead of looking at it in the way that God would look at it. So eventually we know that Delilah gets the better of him and he's betrayed by the woman that he loved. And in verse 21, they finally get their man. They took him, they put out his eyes, they brought him down to Gaza, they bound him with fetters of brass, and he did grind in the prison house. Howbeit, the hair of his head began to grow again after he was shaven. Now, the reaction of the Philistines to capturing Samson is quite interesting, isn't it, in the next verse. The Lord of the Philistines gathered them together for to offer a great sacrifice unto Dagon their God and to rejoice. For they said, our God hath delivered Samson, our enemy, into our hand. When the people saw him, they praised their God, for they said, our God hath delivered into our hands our enemy and the destroyer of our country, which slew many of us. So he's delivered into their hands, and they have this great feast, and we know that he's brought out, this man that they've blinded, and they put him there for sport during this feast in the temple. And we know the consequences, don't we? Samson's been brought low. He's been humbled before God. God has seen what's in his heart. He's been placed in the prison house and he's brought out. And he collapses the columns of the temple. Verse 30. Samson said, let me die with the Philistines. And he bowed himself with all his might. And doesn't that just give us an echo, brothers and sisters, of the words that we have in John chapter 19 and verse 30? Words written about our Lord Jesus. When Jesus therefore had received the vinegar, he said, it's finished. And he bowed his head and gave up the spirit. And in that act, brothers and sisters, we know and understand that sin and death were dealt a very real blow. And I think that is what Samson's foreshadowing as he took hold of those 2 pillars, one for sin and one for death, and he pushed them over. And the record says that the house fell upon the lords and upon all the people that were therein. So the dead which he slew at his death were more than they which he slew in his life. He was a man who brought down the enemy. And in his death, he destroyed those who had destroyed his people. In his death, he destroyed more than he had in his life. Doesn't that just cry to us from the page about the redemptive work of the Lord Jesus Christ? He was a man called from the womb, brought up by a godly mother, a Nazarite all his days, moved by the spirit of Yahweh, tested in the wilderness, rejected by his brothers, betrayed for money, ridiculed by his enemies at his death, who finally breaks free and destroys in his death those who were his oppressors. When you see it like that, it's hard to say that he scrapes into the book of Hebrews. He's a totally living example. Just think about these words from John 12, that Jesus answered them saying, the hour is come that the Son of Man should be glorified. Verily I say unto you, except a corn of wheat fall into the ground and die, it abideth alone. But if it die, it bringeth forth much fruit. He that loveth his life shall lose it, and he that hateth his life in this world shall keep it unto life eternal. And when Samson died, he slew thousands, but he opened the way for Samuel, to some extent Saul, but really for David, so that the Philistines might be destroyed, that the kingdom of God might be established in that sense. And the glory of that kingdom would finally be seen during the reign of Solomon. So here was a man of faith, recorded in Hebrews 11 as such a person. And there's a wonderful picture, isn't there, at the end of Judges 16. I don't know if you've seen this, in verse 31. Then his brethren and all the house of his father came down and took him and brought him up and buried him between Zorah and Eshtaol in the burying place of Manoah his father. And he judged Israel 20 years. And there's a lovely word in that verse. It's a small word, but it's probably the one you want to colour in. It's the word all. All the house of his father. That's really significant, isn't it? Because no one had been at the wedding in Timnath. No one had been at the house of the harlot in Gaza. But in his death, his family were united around him. They realized who he was and what he'd achieved. And he was buried in the burying place of his father between Zorah and Eshtaol, in the land that God had allocated to him and to his seed forever. This is where this faithful man was buried. And that means that on that day of resurrection, when Manoah, his forefather, couldn't quite understand what was going on when Samson disappeared down to Timnath, when he'd gone along with him and organised what was necessary, not really sure what he was doing. "Isn't there a woman in Israel, my son?" he'd said, not realising that all of this was an occasion of the Lord. But when that day of resurrection comes, father and son will be reunited together. That burying place between Zorah and Eshtaol will open up, and out of it will come forth a living Samson and his father and his mother and all of those who prepare to put their trust in God and Samson. And I suppose that brings us full circle, doesn't it? As we finally now do come to Hebrews chapter 11, we can't really not turn to it, can we? Words concerning this sometimes misunderstood man of faith. A man who was misunderstood by everyone except God. A man who through his death brought life. A man who foreshadows the work and life of the Lord and Master. And in Hebrews chapter 11, verse 32, what do we read? "And what more shall I say? For time would fail me to tell of Gideon and Barak and of Samson, of Jephthah, of David also, and Samuel and of the prophets, who through faith subdued kingdoms, wrought righteousness, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions, quenched the violence of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, out of weakness were made strong, waxed valiant in fight, turned to flight the armies of the aliens. Women received their dead raised to life again, and others were tortured, not accepting deliverance, that they might obtain a better resurrection." This is a chapter about faith and resurrection from the dead. This is what Samson believed in, resurrection from the dead. Verse 36, "And others had cruel mockings and scourgings, yea, moreover, bonds of imprisonment. They were stoned, they were sawn asunder, were tempted, were slain with the sword. They wandered about in sheepskins and goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, tormented, of whom the world was not worthy. They wandered in deserts and in mountains and in dens and caves of the earth. And these all, having obtained a good report through faith, received not the promise. God having provided some better thing for us, that they without us should not be made perfect." All of that means, brothers and sisters, that they are waiting for us. Samson has set us the example of his faith, and he and they in this chapter are waiting for us to set ours, so that in that day of resurrection, we might be found standing next to them. We might receive our own good report. Thank you.